American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life. When the words all come down, like blues on Tuesdays come down. Throw it all away.
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines.
I'm Joe, and that's Amy.
Stop. Whoops. I'm Amy, and that's Joe.
And I'm Joe.
And he always screws up the beginning, so.
Not always. Sometimes I don't.
Most of the time.
And we're history for jerks.
Vast majority
I'm
of
I'm Joe, and she's Amy. So if there was any confusion, should we do it
Figured
again?
It out. No, I think we're good.
Okay, this voice you're hearing is Joe.
And this one is Amy.
That's not the voice.
Oh,
you're
that's
gonna,
not my voice.
Oh no, you can commit to it.
No,
commit
I'm not. I don't want to.
Use that voice the whole time.
No, I can't.
Use that voice the whole time.
All right.
Anyway, we are jerks, and we talk about history and American timelines
and
American things. Timelines of American crime. It's kind of crime lines is what we do.
Right. And
Amy talks about murder usually.
Yes. And today we are finishing 1959.
Yeah, but we're not only a true crime podcast. We're also a pop culture and a history podcast and a friendship enjoyment podcast.
That's right.
In fact, the next few episodes, while Amy takes a break and gets ready for school, because we're about to finish season 5. This is the last episode of season 5.
That's right.
I'm going to do a little detour, a little sub-series called Friend Check.
Oh,
where
my
I'm trying to go through my entire Facebook friends list and convince every single person to come on and be a guest and find out about them. Like, why are we friends on Facebook? And then they tell me a story about their life, either an
alien
they've
encountered.
How many
people have you gotten to do this?
I've got 10 so far.
You're
that
kidding.
I've recorded. Yeah. Yeah. People love being on podcasts. And they love, and see what I notice is people love talking about themselves.
Of course
so
they
do. So you talk about them and their life, and then you make them tell them. And then at the end, I say, so why are we Facebook friends again? Because I wanted to start it because
I can't remember half the time how I know certain people.
Yeah, that was and why I
know,
I started.
There's some people I don't know who in the hell they are.
Yeah, I know, that's weird because I don't accept people if I don't know them.
Yeah, me neither.
So I know that I've met them once or interacted.
I've known them.
But I think part of it's that we're getting old. Like
we're forgetting
stuff.
People.
I'm almost 50 and I'm like, shit, who is that person?
Yeah.
Why don't I know? And I get a lot now, and not to brag, but I have over 1,400 friends.
That's a brag.
But now I'm getting people that are trying to add me that I don't know.
I know. That happens.
But it happens to everyone I know. But some people I know why they want to be because I book comedy shows. So
yeah.
I think comedians think, well, if they just friend me that I'll just book them in a show and pay them.
Yeah.
Which I'm not. I'm just not going to do that on Facebook. That's maybe Instagram or something else.
Yeah.
TikTok maybe. But Facebook is where I want my real friends. So the way I'm going to remedy this is I'm going to make each person be on a podcast. So far, the only one person has said no. No, two people. One from high school who was a great buddy. He's like a little brother to me, Aaron Vasco. Rest in peace to his older brother. But he's like, I'm not a podcast guy. I don't want to do it. I was like, just have a beer with me. We'll bullshit and I'll record it. Like, I don't want to do it. And then the one lady who taught with you and her, because I'm going alphabetical by first name, so a bunch of Aarons I have, AJ. The one that she was, I think, a teacher assistant with you and her husband, Ryan, they babysat for us, and he liked Legos.
Abby. Lang.
Abby Lang, yes,
yeah.
Yes.
She because, said no.
Yeah, because A-B-B-A-B comes, like,
yeah.
I did interview a second Abby, Abigail Elfman, but Abby Lang was like, you can have Ryan on there. I was like, I'll get to Ryan when I get to ours, but she was like, no, I really don't feel comfortable doing that, so... So far, only two people said no, but a lot of people said yes. So some of them have podcasts. Some of them are comedians. So it should be fun. I'm going to listen to it, edit, and see if it's interesting. We'll just do that for a little while, but we'll still have Amy come on, and we'll do some regular episodes on stuff we want to talk about. We might just sprinkle in some 40s stuff.
Yeah. There's a couple from the 1800s that would be fun to do.
And I think rather than just forcing ourselves to just go through...
Yeah.
Month by month, let's just
find
stuff.
We'd never get to the Black Dahlia. That's a huge one.
What's that?
That is a 40s one.
It's a 40s one?
Yes.
So why don't we just start working on that one now?
Yeah.
And that way we have less than a week, 2 weeks to, I mean, more than 2 weeks to plan it. Mm-hmm. So you're not just like, oh, shoot, we're down to the wire. I'm just going to read it. You know, this way you can just put it together little by little when you have time, work on it. When you're ready, we can record it because I've got so many of these backlogged now. And
okay.
If we don't lose too many listeners, listening to
your
me
friend
check
bullshit.
With every single one of my friends.
Oh, my
friends.
God.
But the bonus is I have Gruff, Steve Bishop, as from the Gruff and Loud Show, as my co-host. So he make when I'm boy, he makes it awesome.
All right. So let's get started. Enough bullshit.
Yeah. November and December of 1959. And if we take too long, we might extend this into two episodes, too, because... There's
only
a murder
one story.
But there's a murder in December that you could just do for the next one if we decide to push it back.
All right, let's go.
Because I have a fantasy draft at 6. Okay, November 1st, 1959 was a Sunday, and John Howard Griffin, a white writer from Mansfield, Texas, began the process of making himself look black in order to research his classic book, Black Like Me.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that?
Yes.
Have you read it?
I don't know if I read it. I think there was a show they made based on the book, though.
Well, I know they did the parody. Eddie Murphy did that parody, White Like Me.
Yeah.
Remember when he said, the funniest thing about that is like, white people just give each other everything free. Like, you don't have to buy anything. Hey, just take it. You're white.
Yeah.
That was very funny. But I want to read it. This is pretty early for something like that. I guess we're starting to get into the civil rights movement, get into the 60s.
But, that's right.
That was interesting. Jacques Plante, or Jacques Plante, probably. It's P-L-A-N-T-E.
Mm-hmm.
He's a hockey player for the Montreal Canadiens. He became the first NHL goalie in modern times to wear a face mask.
Oh.
Donning it after a shot from Andy Bathgate from the New York Rangers struck him in the face. Imagine getting hit with a hockey puck in the face.
Jesus.
And why didn't they wear masks in the beginning?
And Halloween was never the same.
Yeah, and Jason mm-hmm. started murdering people because of this.
Yep.
The Canadians won 3-1 in that game, and soon all goalies were wearing masks.
Yeah, because
like, yeah, shit, why aren't we wearing masks?
That would ruin your looks.
Yeah,
to put it mildly.
And your teeth.
Oh my God.
Yeah, poor hockey players. Should we have a moment of silence for hockey players?
Well, I don't think. I think they're good.
Well, that brings us to Wednesday, November 4th, 1959, when the government of Morocco imposed emergency measures after more than 6,700 people had been paralyzed by tainted cooking oil.
What?
Yes, and this included the death penalty for manufacturers who sold the oil in McNeese during the Feast of Ramadan in September and October. So peanut oil had been mixed with a jet aircraft engine rinse.
Oh, God.
Purchased as a surplus from the United States Air Force Base in Nuasser.
Who mixed that together?
Nuasser, I guess. I don't know. People trying to save money, I guess. They bought
what?
It like surplus from the... Yeah. The victims were poisoned by tricresyl phosphate. More than 10,000 people eventually required treatment for injuries. 5 of the manufacturers were sentenced to death, but they never actually executed them. I got a lot of this from Latifa Babas on yabaladi.com.
Oh,
but So everybody just started feeling sick.
I bet the food tasted awful, too.
Well, they didn't notice it.
They didn't notice it.
There must have been a smaller amount that they mixed it with a cooking oil. Hundreds of people started complaining about the same symptoms. Some were unable to walk. Others felt that both their legs and hands were suddenly paralyzed. It took them forever to figure it out, and then they finally figured out it was something with food. When the U.S. was about to leave its Air Force bases in Morocco, it sold off many surplus supplies, including TCP-bearing oil that it used for jets. The oil eventually made it to dealers who mixed it with cooking oil and sold it across the country. By the time the medical team discovered the source of the outbreak, the number of victims was still growing. Records show almost 20,000 people were affected by the poisonous oil.
Jesus.
Yeah, so the World Health Organization had to get involved. It was awful.
Yeah.
And that's the same day that U.S. Congressman Charles A. Boyle of Illinois, was 52 years old, was killed an automobile accident as he returned from a long day of campaigning on behalf of Chicago Democrats, and he happens to be Laura Flynn Boyle's grandfather.
Oh, my.
Did you know Laura Flynn Boyle?
Yeah.
Had a grandfather? You did? You always figured she had a grandfather?
Yeah, I figured she probably had
one. People don't talk about Laura Flynn Boyle anymore.
She's skinny.
Yeah. Wasn't she married to Mark Harmon?
No.
She's married to somebody.
I don't think.
There's somebody like that that she was married
I
to.
Think she was maybe married to David Duchovny or somebody.
Might have been Pierce Brosnan.
All right.
Listeners, if you can tell us who Laura Flynn Boyle was married to,
yeah.
we're going to just sit here quietly
no,
until somebody contacts
us. Let's move
us.
On.
Oh, that's impossible. But yeah, go ahead and tweet us at History for Jerks and let us know. Or X us, because tweets, it's not Twitter anymore.
I just deleted, completely deleted
yeah,
that
too.
App.
I did too.
I'm not on there.
So nobody's tweeting at us.
So thread us, maybe.
Yeah, thread us or oh, are we on? We don't have a thread for
oh,
us. TikTok us at Gruff and Loud Show
TikTok
or
us.
Instagram us at History for Jerks. You can
That's probably
Insta-
the best.
Us. You can gram us.
What do they say? They don't say gram us.
I don't think they use it as a verb. I think they just say message us on Instagram.
Send us a thing something. On Instagram.
Send us a fax.
They need something to say.
And that brings us to our first birthday. Hit it, Matt Truman Ego Trip, the birthday theme song, because Amy hates them.
Amy hates birthdays. Amy hates birthdays.
November 5th, 1959 was a Thursday. You want to guess what pop singer from Canada, Kingston, Ontario, was born? His middle name is Guy.
I don't know.
The son of Elizabeth Jane and Conrad J. Adams, who were an English couple who emigrated to Canada from Plymouth in the 50s.
No idea.
Blank Guy Adams.
I don't know.
His father was an officer in the British Army.
Honey, I don't think
Canadian.
I know this
Brian
person.
Adams.
Oh, okay.
Brian Adams.
I never would have guessed that.
I was going to start saying like... cuts like a knife stuff and everything.
All right. Well, that should have been the first clue.
Whoa.
Instead of his middle name is Guy, like I'm going to know that.
Brian Adams attended at Argyle Secondary School, home of the Pipers, and Jason Priestley is a fellow alumni.
Hmm.
Remember Jason Priestley? Wait, is
yeah.
he the one who died or is it the other one from 90210?
No, it's the other one, I think.
I don't remember the other one.
They might both be dead. I don't know.
Uh-oh. Hopefully they're not. Sorry to 902 fans.
Yeah.
90210 fans. Anyway, Brian Adams bought his first electric guitar at the age of 12.
Mm-hmm.
He bought his first real six string in Reading, an Italian brand from Gerson based on a Fender Stratocaster, according to an interview with music magazine Guitar World. Adam said, I bought an imitation Les Paul at a five and dime store. He bought his first real six string at a five and dime.
So he's singing about the truth.
Yeah, in Ottawa, Canada in 1971. Before that, I had an imitation Strat, which I bought in Reading, England in 1970. Anyway, November 7th was a Saturday in 1959, and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Taft-Hartley Act and ordered 500,000 striking steelworkers to return to work for the next 80 days in an 8-1 decision. Justice Douglas dissenting, so the court declared that the strike imperils the national safety. So you can't go on strike if it imperils the safety
of
the country. So
that's why the rail workers couldn't go
on strike. Yeah, they couldn't because it'll ruin our country.
Yeah.
Wow. Country first, everybody. And that November 9th was a Monday, and it was 17 days before Thanksgiving, and Arthur Fleming, the U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, warned that some of the 1959 crop of cranberries was tainted.
Taint? You said taint.
Taint. With the carcinogen aminotrozioli. I'm sure that's not how you say it.
That's sure.
And he said that, quote, if a housewife doesn't know where the berries in a product came from, she should be on the safe side and she shouldn't buy. Cranberry sales plummeted, but producers responded by finding ways to promote year-round sales of cranberry products to make up for the loss, including cranberry juice.
Oh.
So we didn't have, people didn't drink cranberry juice until that happened.
Yeah, because they realized they needed it. What a reason to be around.
Yeah, so cranberry juice probably isn't that good for you.
No.
And it was very sexist that he just says that about housewives buying cranberry sauce.
Oh, yeah.
November 10th was a Monday. And two birthdays, but I'm not going to do any background or birthday song for this one because... Linda Cohn, the first full-time female sports anchor in the U.S., was born in Selma, New York, so women's history. Hoorah!
Okay.
And then in pedophilia / incest news, Mackenzie Phillips, American TV actress from One Day at a Time, was born in Alexandria, Virginia. And everybody knows she banged her dad.
I don't think everybody knows that.
They don't?
Don't think.
John Philip from the Mamas and the Papas had a consensual sexual relationship with his daughter, Mackenzie Phillips.
Oh, how old was she?
I don't know. It started when she was a teenager, I think.
Ew.
And people, nobody canceled him. But nope. She said it was consensual. Poor China Phillips.
Oh, my God. That's outrageous.
Do you know who the third famous sister is? Mackenzie Phillips, China Phillips, and there's one more. And it's not Bijou.
I don't know.
I mean, it is Bijou. Dang it. It's not Busy Phillips. All Busy right. Phillips isn't
Can
one
we move
with
on?
Bijou. Sorry.
I don't know why we're talking about that.
I don't know why Wilson we are Phillips. Either. It's just trivia. But that brings us to Amy's awful, horrible murder.
Oh, yes.
So those of you who don't like awful, horrible murders, and you're just listening for the stupid pop culture shit that I say, you might want to turn off the podcast. Those of you who have been bored out of your mind, punching yourself in the face, listening to my bullshit, well, now is your favorite part of the podcast, and you can stop fast-forwarding.
So I'm going to tell the story of the Clutter family murders, and this is the basis for Truman Capote's book In Cold Blood.
Ooh, really? You're saying Clutter family, C-L-U-T-T-E-R?
Yes.
Never heard of it.
I'm going to read the beginning of this article by Berlin Sylvester on Ranker.com.
Berlin Sylvester on Ranker.com. Okay.
All right. Holcomb, Kansas was a quaint American town of roughly 300 residents.
Okay. Small town.
It was the nearly languid type of place in the Midwest where no one's a stranger and everyone and their cousins are welcome to dinner.
Oh, I love languid.
It was a time when milk was still delivered in glass quart bottles to the front porches of families, when most sports were listened to by people sitting around a radio, when no one even locked their doors.
I still don't lock my door.
For four of the six members of the Clutter family, a father, a mother, and their two youngest children, this tradition of trust sealed their demise on the evening of November 15th, 1959, when two men, Perry Smith and Richard Hickok, brutally murdered the entire family with the hopes of finding cash in the home.
Ugh, I got a bad feeling about this one.
The criminal pair had it on good authority that the Clutters kept a large safe in their home with at least $10,000 in it. Wow. The Clutters had no such safe, and they lost their lives because of it.
Oh, no. They didn't even have a safe?
No. So let's now dive deeply into the true story behind Truman Capote's novel.
Wait, are we diving deeply, or is that what the author said? Let's dive deeper.
No, that was what I said.
Oh, you did. Okay.
Killers Richard Hickok and Perry Smith.
Okay.
Okay, those are the killers.
Two killers. Richard Hickok.
They walk in
Perry
the front
Smith.
Door.
Dick Hickok.
Yes. They walk in the front door of the farmhouse.
Yeah.
They had a Savage Model 300 gauge shotgun and a sizable sturdy knife.
Wow.
They
just walked right in.
Yep. And saw Herbert Clutter, the dad.
Oh, no, sorry. This is terrible.
Will you stop? He was sleeping.
Yeah, I know. Poor guy.
They woke him up, and then they started asking him where the safe was and where the cash was. And he was like, I don't have a safe. I don't have any cash. I don't know what you're talking about.
Is there any reason why everybody thought that? Or was it just a rumor mill?
Well, I'll get there.
Okay, gotcha.
So they
said, I don't have a safe.
He said he had no idea. There was no safe. The Finney County Sheriff, Kevin Baskew, says, I don't think they wanted to take that answer at that time. I think that they still felt there was a safe there, and they didn't drive all the way across Kansas for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's going to tell. I mean, even if he had a safe, he wouldn't tell them.
So they get mad. Hold on a minute.
Lose their temper.
They get mad. They tie the Clutters, the whole family up. With these inescapable knots on their wrists and ankles.
Huh.
And
I'm glad they didn't use escapable knots.
They kill Mr. Clutter by slashing his throat.
Oh, God. Poor guy.
And it was Smith who slashed his throat before shooting him in the head.
Yikes. So if you're going to shoot him in the head, why slice his throat too?
I don't know. And they could have fled the scene once they realized there was no cash in the home and hoped never to be recognized for breaking and entering, but instead they choose
kill
everybody.
That makes me think they've probably killed before.
So, they were angry because they didn't find anything. You know, they took it out on the family. So they, once the family members were secured, they put a bullet through the head of Mrs. Bonnie Clutter, 16-year-old Nancy Clutter, and 15-year-old Kenyon Clutter. One would think it would be easier to keep a slaughter nice and neat by having everyone who's set to die in one place. But instead, Herb Clutter was killed in the basement. His wife was killed in her room upstairs. His daughter, 16-year-old Nancy, was killed in her own bedroom.
Jeez.
His son, 15-year-old Kenyon, was tied to a piece of furniture, and each one of them died alone.
Really?
So they separated them.
I mean, they didn't just... Well, I guess you don't know.
So the chief of the Garden City Police Department, Mitchell Geisler, mm-hmm. arrived on the scene with Assistant Chief Rich Rollader or something.
Or something similar to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they were first on the scene, and what they discovered was the grisliest slaying in the town had ever seen. Mr. Clutter was splayed across a blood-soaked mattress in the basement. Tape covered his mouth. A shotgun blast undid his head. A slash exposed the innards of his throat.
Ugh.
In the next room was 15-year-old Kenyon, who was tied and bound to a piece of furniture. A head split via shotgun lolled upon his shoulders. Not sure what that means. Upstairs, then...
I don't know, but it sounds gross.
In separate rooms, and we already said that, Mrs. Clutter, 16-year-old Nancy... Mrs. Clutter was bound, gagged, and dead of a shotgun blast to the head also. Nancy was only bound, not gagged, meaning she most likely begged for her life freely, but was given the same treatment as the rest of the family. After ransacking the home, killers Perry Smith and Richard Hickok made off with practically nothing. They ended up with no more than $50, a pair of binoculars, and a transistor radio.
Yeah, I was going to say, wouldn't you think,
they've been
like...
told by a fellow jail inmate that there was a safe, and that's why.
So... I was say, wouldn't you think like if you can just walk in a door, people aren't going to have a safe? You know, it's like,
right? Yeah,
if they leave their doors unlocked,
that's
they probably
true.
Don't have much?
Yeah. So, Assistant Chief Rollader was a keen photographer who made sure to document the scene in the early days of forensic photography. The images he captured, there was one of a bloody boot print belonging to Smith. That was very key in helping the prosecutors put the nail in the coffin for Smith and Hickok was that boot print and a lot of his pictures. Other items that assisted in their eventual conviction were a bloody rope and tire tracks that belonged to a car in their possession. Once the pair were located, the shotgun and the bloody knife used in the murders were found right alongside them. So it was just all this evidence. It was just
so they didn't
damning.
Even like try to like clean the knife or hide
they
it.
Didn't yeah all right so let's talk a little bit about the family, the Clutters.
Yeah.
Herb Clutter. He was the dad.
Yeah.
Very upstanding, owned a successful farm. He was in the church.
Yeah.
Did a lot of city committees. He didn't drink or smoke.
Yeah. Well known, the Clutters. The Clutter farm, probably. If it was a successful farm, that's why people thought they had a lot of money.
And his wife was Bonnie Clutter. She studied to be a nurse, but her dreams were dashed. So she was afflicted with depression after the birth of her last child, and her condition was so bad.
Postpartum ain't no joke.
She was known as bedridden and fragile.
Aww,
still,
lady.
The show had to go on with four children and a bevy of farmhands to keep fed. So her husband, Herb, was truly supportive and understanding. Well, there's two that survived.
There's two that survived?
I'll get to it. Yeah, they weren't there. They were older.
Oh.
So they were not home.
Moved out.
They'd moved out,
they didn't
yeah.
live there.
They didn't live there. Right. Her husband, Herb, was truly supportive and understanding. And all right, Nancy Clutter, then the daughter, the 16-year-old, she was considered the darling of the town. She was an excellent student and musician. She was known for her kindness, intelligence. Kenyon Clutter was known as a bit of a loner. When his soul buddy found a girlfriend, Kenyon was left to do what he loved in solitude, disassemble electronic gadgets and rebuild them.
Happens to a lot of dudes, man. You're
the
dude,
two
your
eldest
friend,
daughters. Who survived the slaying.
Yeah, that didn't live there.
Eviana and Beverly.
Okay.
They had moved out before the murder slaughter there.
So they didn't really survive it because they weren't there.
So let's meet the first killer, Perry Smith.
Okay.
He helped slaughter the family. So his life
was
full of abuse. He was the son of an abusive father. He was whisked away with his siblings to what was supposed to be a safer place. An alcoholic, his mother died soon after by choking on her own vomit, leaving her children to the care of a Catholic orphanage.
This is so pleasant.
Smith claims that to escape the abuse at the hands of the orphanage, he and his siblings found themselves in another home for children run by the Salvation Army. But there, the abuse continued. He said there was an incident in which an authority figure attempted to drown him. Once out of the care of the Salvation Army, two of his siblings committed suicide at an early age.
Oh, man.
The remaining sibling simply made herself inaccessible by moving away and discontinuing contact with him.
Yuck.
It's believed that Smith's trauma stunted his ability to develop normal emotions and responsible actions throughout his life. He did join the army. He did fight in Korea a little bit. But he was a troublemaker. He liked to start fights. So he was honorably discharged in 1952. His violent tendencies and his inability to manage his anger issues were cited in court. In 4 years, he'd been sentenced to 5 to 12 years of prison time for the charge of breaking and entering. And then during this time, he had met his partner. That's where he met Richard Hickok. It was while he was in jail for that. So now we're talking about Richard. Richard was born into poverty. So you can see abuse or poverty, they both do things that create crime in our society. So we should do everything in our power to try to reduce the amount of poverty and abuse in our society. But that's a whole other story.
Abuse, I can see. Poverty, I mean, a lot of people have poverty and don't murder everyone. Look at John Randall, the defensive tackle.
I agree that a lot of people do that, but also guaranteed most of the people, a lot of the people that do this kind of murder, like home invasion murders, I guarantee you most of them have grown up in poverty.
Yeah, struggling.
When you don't have your basic needs met. Okay, anyway.
All right. So meet basic needs, everybody. And these billionaires don't need so much, right? Like, why more?
I know.
Let's
not go off
on
this.
Anyway.
All right. So he was a talented and popular high school athlete.
Yes.
But he didn't have the money to go to college. Because So he became a mechanic, got married, had three children with his wife and another with his mistress. He wound up single in the end. He was good looking in his youth. But he had a car accident in 1950.
Yeah.
That made him...
scarred?
It did.
Scarred him?
It left him bitter and insecure. He turned to small-time criminal activity like penny theft and check
fraud. If he hadn't had that, he was still poor but good-looking. Good looks can get you a lot of places.
That's true. So the killers learned about the Clutter Farm from a fellow inmate. They weren't ready to lead an honest life, so they planned it... based on all this information, but it was all wrong information.
Yeah, incorrect.
So in March of 1960, they were put on trial in Garden City, Kansas, each for 4 counts of first-degree murder.
Okay.
They were media sensations. The nation was on the edge for details and justice.
Yeah.
The particular speediness of this case closure was due to fine police work and a photograph of a bloody boot print matching those worn by Richard Hickok. Additionally, the pair kept the murder weapons, and when police caught up with them, they confiscated them as evidence. And they did get the death penalty, even though Kansas is not a state known for many death sentences, but they did get sentenced to death in the end.
Good.
They decided to have their lives taken by firing squad, hanging from the neck until dead was granted to the pair for better or for worse.
Wait a minute.
They wanted,
a firing squad.
Yes, that's right. So for the next 5 years, the pair would sit on death row and contemplate the nature of their crimes, among the other heinous things that come to mind when people know the only exit from prison will come in a pine box.
Yikes.
After 5 years of sitting on death row, they were met with their own demise April 14th, 1965.
Wow.
Just hours before the director of the Kansas State Penal Institution, Charles McAtee, saw Richard say his goodbyes to his ex-wife. She'd come to pay respects and offer an apology for a letter she had written him that was telling him off and stuff.
I wonder if she had guilt about it. Like, she caused the whole thing.
Well, she was just saying she was sorry that she had sent him that nasty letter. The doomed man insisted she tell him his children goodbye, and when she left, it became clear to McAtee that Hickok was able to see the extent of pain he'd caused many people. Yeah. McAtee is quoted. He said, "Mr. McAtee, I should have had my neck broke long ago before we pulled that caper out in Kansas for what I did to that woman and my kids." For 10 hours before their official hanging, the director of the Kansas State Penal Institution, Charles McAtee, spent a little time getting to know the condemned men. Perry Smith created paintings of the sea, and he also wrote poetry.
I wonder if those paintings are worth anything.
Probably.
Is there like a true crime thing that people love to collect crime black market?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Really?
Because like a lot of them paint in jail and stuff and sell their work.
And so there's probably some people sitting around like junkies are like, "Ooh, look at this."
Yeah, John Wayne Gacy or
John
whatever.
Wayne Gacy's shoes. That's creepy, kind of. Would you rather be hung or shot by a firing squad? You think?
No question.
This isn't hanging supposed to be like instant. Well, I guess
you
hang there for a while, but
they also
snap your neck.
They also botch it all
the
time.
Ugh. Well, the firing squad could botch it too. You got to bleed out.
Not if you have.
I guess if it's enough.
Ten people with guns pointed at you, and they're just Boom, 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 boom.
What
boom.
If they just point at your balls and just shoot your balls all
Oh, my God.
I don't know. I don't want
so
any
then,
of these
So then while they were in jail, Truman Capote went to jail and interviewed him a bunch of times and got real close with him and stuff.
Wow.
And
it became chummy.
Wrote that book. And in 2009, the Holcomb City Council firmly staked a memorial in the ground of the park dedicated to the slain Clutters. The memorial talks of their lives, not the unfortunate death of the family.
Poor Clutters. I wonder what happened if the sisters like took over the farm. And
I don't know. So that's a Clutters. Story of the Clutter family murders.
Yeah, that was not exciting. That was just gross.
Yeah, it was gross. I think home invasions are some of the scariest.
They are scary, especially after last happen. Night with our dog barking 3 a.m.
Well, it could happen, and like, what do you do?
Luckily, we don't have anything.
Right.
I mean, you leave your car unlocked all the time.
I know. I shouldn't do that.
Okay. Well, let's finish up November, shall we?
All right.
November 16th was a Monday, and National Airlines Flight 967 with 42 people on board crashed into the Gulf of Mexico while en route from Tampa to New Orleans. Though an onboard bomb was suspected, the physical evidence was lost in the Gulf, and they don't know what happened.
Oh.
November 18th. The 1959 film Ben-Hur debuted at New York's Lowe's Theater in 70mm Ultra Panavision before nationwide and then worldwide release.
Did you see that?
Yeah, in school. We watched it in school. It was a remake of a 1925 silent film, which was in turn a remake of a 1907 silent film based on a book from 1880.
Oh.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I didn't like it.
I
mean, it was boring, but I was a kid.
Charlton
I was in
Heston
high school.
In it?
Yeah. Okay. Charlton Heston might be in it. That's my Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston's in Ten Commandments. I know that.
Yeah, yeah. I just remember watching it being bored, but I also was a stupid high school kid who didn't have a very long attention span.
Yeah.
All I wanted to do was, like, date girls and go barfing at the mall. Anyway. It would go on to become the most popular film of the year and would win a record 12 Academy Awards. I mean, who's into ancient Rome time? I mean, I just really wasn't into that. Anyway, November 19th, 1959 was a Thursday, and the Rocky and Bullwinkle show was introduced. The cartoon was shown on ABC network stations at 5:30 each afternoon and was originally called Rocky and Friends, although Bullwinkle the Moose soon became more popular than Rocky the Flying Squirrel, so they had to change it.
Yeah, they love Bullwinkle.
Yeah. Then the following Sunday, November 22nd, in Minneapolis, on the morning of the American Football League's first owners' meeting, they were going to start the AFL to rival the NFL. The Minneapolis Star-Journal carried a headline, Minnesota to get NFL franchise. And the owners of the AFL Minneapolis team denied the story because the Minnesota Vikings were going to be in the AFL. But soon,
I've tuned you out like a paragraph ago, just by the way.
They were awarded the NFL's 14th team, the Minnesota Vikings. They decided the Vikings would start in 1961. But everybody was upset because Minnesota was supposed to be in the AFL, so they replaced them with the Raiders. The Oakland Raiders would have never joined or existed if the Vikings hadn't gone to the NFL. So there you go, Vikings.
Okay.
I'm a Vikings fan, so I left that in there. Nobody else cares.
Nobody does.
November 24th was a Tuesday. And TWA Flight 595, a cargo plane with 3 crew members on board, crashed into a Chicago neighborhood adjacent to Midway Airport. At 5:37 in the morning, the Constellation airplane crashed at the corner of 64th and Knox Avenue and destroyed apartments and bungalows.
Boom.
In addition to the crew, 8 people on the ground were killed and 13 more were injured. A lot of plane crashes in the 50s.
I know. They needed the training wheels still on those planes.
Yeah. And then the end of November, it was on that of the stories we're going to talk about, were on November 28th, and it was a Saturday. The first of the Nashville sit-ins aimed at ending the policy of discrimination against African-Americans at lunch counters began with a test run at Harvey's Department Store in downtown Nashville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
By 1960, the nonviolent protests were being duplicated successfully and nationwide.
Good.
And that's the same day that we got another birthday, November 28th. This is your favorite birthday. You're going to get so excited about this.
Oh.
Because this is probably one of your favorite actors of all time.
Amy hates birthdays. Amy hates birthdays.
Oh.
From the Breakfast Club, born in Portland, Maine. Actor Judd Nelson, the son of Merle, a court mediator and former member of the Maine House of Representatives, and Leonard Nelson, a corporate lawyer. His father was the first Jewish president of the Portland Symphony Orchestra. Judd Nelson has two sisters, Eve and Julie. He went to school at St. Paul School in Concord, New Hampshire, and Wayne Fleet School in Portland, Maine, home of the Flyers, and Linda Lavin is a notable alumni. That's the end of November. Should we just
stop?
You want to just stop and do a separate one for December since I have a murder that I can give you?
Yeah, that's fine.
Or do you want to look it up first?
No.
Or have me just burn through all this?
No, no.
All right, we're going to do one more. We're going to get a bonus episode, American Time Heads. We're going to end here on November, and you're going to get a December one because I found a murder that Amy can cover next month for December of 1959. So one more episode with the old format. Thank you for listening. Sorry we haven't put one out in a little while. We were supposed to do one 2 weeks ago, and things got hectic, man.
Yeah, they
things
did.
Got hectic.
Sure
I got
did.
Attacked by a bear. Amy
started school.
Became a ninja. And defeated a whole army of evil Nazis.
All right. It's time to get out of here, Chuck Berry.
Truman Ego Trip is the greatest band of all time. Buy their music.